We are going to finish the public today. Okay, any questions about anything before we start? I was hoping to have your midterms today. They're about halfway now.
How are they looking?
Okay. Yeah, Max?
I was thinking, and so everything is an incomplete imitation of the form of the good. And
no, you were just gonna say I was thinking.
I was thinking, period. So everything is an incomplete perspective of the form of the good. And human intelligence obviously does exist. So you got me thinking, does the good think? Does it have thought? Because it seems like that's the conclusion that he's gonna draw.
Draw that?
I don't think so. I didn't see it at least.
Not at the end, no. We get something close to that.
Like, I remember him saying that it saw, it has sight. That was awesome.
Well, not that the good has sight. The good doesn't have sight. But you got the right idea here. What's the passage that you're thinking of? What's the passage that Matt's thinking
of? 1 and 7?
Yeah, the sun. Yeah, the image of the sun. The sun is responsible. Sight doesn't work on its own. You can't just have an eye and an object for the eye to see, and then all of a sudden sight is just going to happen. It has to be this third thing, the sun. The sun is responsible for the being as well as the being seen of all the things that are seen. And then he talks about the eye, and he says the eye is the most sun-like of the senses. So there seems to be some sort of... The sun seems to be, at least in the analogy, on both sides of the opposition. It's not just making the thing seen visible, it's making the thing that is seeing able to do the seeing. Right? So what do we know, about causes from all the way back in book one? They must have the characteristic that they're causing and the effect to a higher degree. So it seems like he's talking about the sun as if it's some sort of self-seeing. That doesn't make any sense. The sun is a big eye in the sky looking at itself. Alright, it's kind of neat. You know, we can think about it and it's looking at itself and radiating all this light. But it doesn't really mean it. It can't be it. You can't see it because it doesn't have a cornea.
Well, we see it though, and we're sort of it, right?
Okay, so we have to go to the other side of the analogy. The good. Intelligence, intellect, is capable of a sort of a reflexivity that material things are. So when we go to the other side of the analogy and we think about the good as being responsible both for the being and the being something, is how Socrates puts it. The good is responsible for the being and the being something of things, and for the knowing of the knower. So now we have the same thing. The good is responsible for knowing and for being. It would seem to have knowing and being to the highest degree. What would that make you good? Anybody here read Aristotle's Metaphysics? Oh, thinking itself, yeah. The good is, Matt, exactly what you're suggesting, at least on this interpretation, it's some sort of self-thinking thought. It's the greatest possible thought. What would the greatest possible thought be contemplating? The greatest possible object. Well, it's that too. There's a whole tradition that reads Plato this way. This is what the Neoplatonists do. They take, well, look, the good is, it's the same thing that Aristotle is talking about as God. It's So Plato and Aristotle are really saying the same thing. And it's amazing how easy it is to read Plato in that way. It's just one small problem. We can't really conceive of what that means. I mean, thought thinking itself, it's pretty neat, and it works. Like, we can see how we're led to it. But what does that mean? Well, we can't make sense of it, but we can make sense of why we can't make sense of it. How do we make sense of why we can't make sense of it?
I guess you don't
understand
the good word.
That's it exactly. To understand the good, if the good is a self-understanding, you have to become the good. So the way I'm understanding Plato is that he sort of stops short of saying the good is thought thinking itself. It looks like it's some sort of self-thinking because it's responsible for both thinking and being. But we can't really make that leap. Because to make that leap is to think thought thinking itself. And then what are you talking about? Then you really start sounding. That's sort of the point, that if you did understand it, if you thought you understood it, you'd be making a mistake. What we cannot, because it doesn't make sense, but what we can see is why we would think it. We've got this thing, the form of the good, and it's responsible for our ability to know, and also for the ability of all things to be. So it must have this character of knowing and of being to the highest possible degree. Okay, well, what does the thing that has knowing to the highest possible degree know? Well, go back to book 5 and the distinction of the powers. The stronger powers know the truer object. The thing that has the highest possible knowledge would know the thing that exists to the highest possible degree. Well, the good's both of those things. If we follow it out, when we get to the top on either side, the knowing and the being, we get the good. Which is interesting, because down here, when we talk about the sun, we can't really talk about something seeing itself, because sight requires an external object. But when we think about knowledge, the closer we get to knowledge, the further we get to the material, the further we get from that need for externality. Not only is the stronger power set over the higher object, as you get higher up, the powers and the objects seem to get closer together, which is also interesting. And also leads to the same conclusion. Okay, but anyways, what about us? This is actually the topic for today. We can't be the good. What can we be?
Philosophers.
What do philosophers know? Well, I thought we were supposed to know the good. Isn't that what we've been saying? Right? You're right to be hesitant. What else does he talk about philosophers as knowing? Order. And which order exactly? Yeah, and that's what it says in book 4. The reason, at least, for philosophy is set over the soul or state as a whole. Well, that seems to be a problem. Sometimes he says reason is set over the good, itself by itself, or whatever the phrase is. And sometimes he says that reason is set over the soul as a whole. Are they the same thing?
I think so.
Got two votes.
Anybody else?
Can you be the good?
Well, everything is sort of good.
Trying and become more like the good. How does that work? You can, first of all, you can't be the good. Why not?
Because you have a body.
So you have a body. And what does the body force you to do? This really is what we're supposed to be talking about today. I know it just sounds like Matt was thinking the last empty rail. Yeah? Okay, it is a material thing. The soul has desires. What do desires do? Somehow they distract you. So how do they distract you, Alex? Can we now have a new way of talking about what is so bad about desire? You have to go after material things. And where are the material things? In the cave. They're outside of the soul. Why is that significant? Where does knowledge look? It looks at itself. At least that seems to be what it does in the highest sense. Knowledge is supposed to be set over, in some way, set over itself. It's set over what is, but it also is something that is. Desires force the soul to look outside of itself. So now we have a sort of a puzzle. We've got the soul that has these desires. And it's forcing the soul to look outside of itself. But what the soul really needs to do is to look at itself. Reason is set over the whole soul. At least that's the first way of thinking about reason. So what happens to reason when, in Book 7, he says, look, it's a turning of the whole soul. And when he says it's a turning of the whole soul, he says it's a turning of the whole soul to look at the good. But what is the turning of the whole soul? It's somehow ordering all the desires so that they act along with reason. Well, what's happening to the soul when you do that? Why is it looking at itself? What's happening to it as an object? Becoming more one, more unified, more just, more like the form. Well, we had a contradiction. The contradiction is that reason is, it's set over the whole soul and it's set over the good, and they're different. So how do you get rid of the contradiction? That's it. You try to get the whole soul as close to the good as possible. And in that way, the soul comes to be set over itself. And comes to be like the good by being set over itself. It's pretty neat. That's to me, that's the central sort of, I guess, dialectic, what people would call it. The central dialectic of the text. In coming to be set over itself, the soul comes to be like the good.
Isn't the contradiction still there until the soul is exactly like the good?
Yes. That's a good thing to notice. The contradiction's still there, and it never goes away, and yet we still get to be just. How's that? Last part of the fifth. What have we needed all along, you know? That you're the one who's always you always jump in when we get to
it's outside himself or and inside himself or somewhere in the chamber.
We need an end that's internal to the soul. And if it's unachievable, all the better. Well, isn't that what we just got? The end is the unification of the soul with the good. We can never quite unify the soul with the good. But in striving for that, we now have an internal end. An internal end that includes the whole soul as the object and the good as object, in the attempt to make them the same. That striving itself is the philosophical life. Not just as a means to an end. It's sort of a means to an end, but you're never going to become the good as long as you have a body. As an end in itself. As the internal end for the soul. The turning away from the desires, the turning of the soul to itself. It's both ruling and philosophy at the same time. They have to be the same. Yeah.
I think you said this, but I'm not sure I get it. What do we do with the desires that have to go outside? Like, they're still part of the soul, so how do we fix that? I think I am confused. Right? Like, you have to go outside of your body or whatever, outside of your soul to fulfill your desires. But that part, it's like still...
It's still there.
Yeah.
That's right. It doesn't go away.
So how does that part of your soul turn towards itself and become closer to the good? It's there three parts.
It doesn't do so perfectly.
Okay.
But what does it do?
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, how does it do it imperfectly? How do you eat? So that you can go back to doing philosophy. Once we have the end, at least, then we have a way of organizing the things that are for the sake of that end. The end is the doing of philosophy. It's internal to the soul, and now all those connections that the soul has to its externality, it can use for the sake of that internality. It's the second best. Be better if we didn't have desires or didn't have a body.
Yeah, or if it wasn't like part of the soul that turns towards itself.
Yeah.
Because I just feel like that.
Yeah. Well, you're going to get, that's what we're going to talk about today. But unfortunately, it's an insoluble problem. This is one of Plato's other famous dialogues, the Phaedo. Has anybody read the Phaedo? No? Nobody's read the Phaedo? Read the Phaedo? Two people, that's it. It's a good book, you should check it out. Socrates he's really arguing that the soul is immortal. And he says, look, we're never gonna have knowledge as long as we're in the body. We shouldn't fear death. If anything, death is the puzzle is why we don't just try to expedite it. Because we're never gonna have knowledge in the body. In the Republic, we both see why that's the case and also see what to do in the body in the face of that. Because we still got to deal with this thing. And the most puzzling part of the thing is that it isn't connected to the soul at all. Right? That's what Book 10 is about. The soul doesn't really belong here. It's just stuck here. And because it's stuck here, it's covered up with all this stuff. And what we need to do is... It's like you got to just keep cleaning this stuff off. And you know it's going to come back, but you just got to keep cleaning it off. Like a sea statue that's constantly getting encrusted over with seaweed and shells or whatever it is. Just gotta keep cleaning it up. outside thinking and incredible class. All right, other questions?
No.
We're gonna jump back in. We need to do the immortality argument.
I was gonna ask, like, because we did that as a quiz the other day, and it's saying, like, okay, so injustice is the only thing that is bad for the soul, and you know, therefore the soul is the one that can't be destroyed. But what happens when your body dies? I mean, I know Socrates believed that you couldn't know what happened after you died, but it seems like after you die, your soul just you can't do anything. So. With that.
Your soul can't do anything anymore?
It seems like your soul derives from your ability to do and think, which is the ability of your mind, which is the ability of your brain.
Oh, really?
I think so. The
brain. Yeah. Is that where thoughts? That's where thoughts are? Hanging out in the brain? I thought it was the heart. But it doesn't matter where it is. Is there anything that the soul can do when it's not connected to the body? That's what we just concluded. It's not going to desire, right? You're not going to get hungry if you don't have a body. Or if you are, it's going to be a puzzle. I don't know what you're going to be hungry for. You're not going to need spirit, because what does spirit do? Well, it controls the appetites, and it stops external things from impinging. That is, in some sense, a major puzzle for Socrates. And when he answers it in Phaedo, he gives a really lousy answer. He says, look, we belong to the gods, and if we kill ourselves, the gods are going to be mad because we're stealing their possessions. Which isn't a good answer. What's a slightly better answer?
What? Desire to become yourself.
I think that's it. What are you doing in killing yourself? You're acting for an external end. You're acting as if you're trying to get to something that you don't have already.
But, sorry, going off on a tangent, isn't that what you do when you feed yourself and give yourself a drink? Satisfy desire, so you can philosophize. You know, the best way to philosophize is without a body, is the best thing to do to get to that.
I told you it was only a part.
Does he actually say that in the book, the desire part?
Which part?
The part where.
He doesn't talk about it. Not here. In the Phaedo, he gives the answer, I think. For some reason, we're in this body. We don't really know why. We don't have a good enough knowledge to act for the sake of killing ourselves. In fact, what we need to avoid is acting for the sake of any external end. Because we don't know which external ends are good. They're all good, because they're all instances of the good, but none of them are really good. So if we choose to kill ourselves, we are claiming to know what is good. But the whole reason we would choose to kill ourselves is because as long as we're in the body, we can't know what's good. So it's a contradiction. Suicide is contradictory. You just gotta stick it out. Unfortunately. I always feel bad at this point. What if somebody...
See that one in the back?
All right. Don't do it. All right. All right. So where were we? Let's go back to where we were in the text on Tuesday and get through the chapter. Imitation? What was the problem with poetry?
Imitation of imitation.
An imitation of an imitation. 2 degrees removed from the truth. Okay. And yet he's talking about it here and using it. So, but we noticed like a sort of a positive side to at least talking about imitation. What was that? We have this relationship between the painting and the thing. And when we're looking at that relationship, we can see clearly what the relationship between a thing and its imitation is. And that's handy because the thing itself is an imitation. An imitation of something that we can't see so clearly. The form. So, what does that give us an opportunity to do? Take the relationship between the painting and the thing and use it to try to understand the relationship between the thing and the form. And that's what we did last time. So what was that relationship again?
There's one in the middle of it.
Okay, one and many. Go ahead, Jeff.
The imitation being, we have many instances, whereas they all, obviously, every couch, even though they're different in themselves, have, you know, something about them that we call them a couch. So I guess they all share something that is couchless.
Well, let's start with the couch and the picture of the couch. Every picture of the couch paints the couch, draws the couch from a different perspective. They're all going to look different. And really, they may not have anything in common with each other. It could be different colors, depending on the light. Different shapes, depending on the angle. They don't even have a texture. They're all of the same couch, but none of them have anything to do with each other. Yeah?
Don't hit that. It's a summer resemblance of the couch.
Yeah, what part of the couch do they resemble? The perspective, or well, what's Socrates' favorite word here? It's not the being of the couch. You can't paint the being. It's the appearance. And there are a bunch of different appearances that aren't really connected to each other at all. They're all somehow, in a way that's not entirely clear, connected to the being, but they're not connected to each other. They're all imitations. They're partial representations of this being, but they're not even really representations of the being, they're just representations of the appearance. That's the way an imitation relates to that of which it's an imitation. Okay, so what about the couch and form? Well, the couch is a partial reflection or an appearance, partial appearance of the form. It's not the being of the form. It's just the appearing of the form. Well, what is the couch? It's an order or structure. Well, I thought that was being. Not quite. What's being? You've got this order or structure. Well, what makes it be? It's in. Good. The order is what it is in relation to being. So what's the end of the couch? Well, I don't know. Comfort or whatever it is. It's the good that the couch serves. What's the one form that all of these things are partial reflections of? It's the good. But they don't have the being of the good. They just have a certain appearing of the good. Well, what's the appearing? Their good is external to them. It's the internal-external distinction again. Because the good of the couch is external to the couch is sometimes good and sometimes bad. It's good for watching TV and bad for, I don't know, couches are bad for, maybe couches are bad for, just sleeping or playing soccer. I mean, they're bad for something. That's why the printing is easier. So I can make my children's toy jet, but they're so tired of it. But at any rate, they have their good in a totally different way. They don't really have it. The analogy is actually very, very tight, considering how difficult it is to make an analogy of the soul. The order that is the thing isn't really a being in the way that the end of the thing is a being. We need something that has its end in itself if that thing is really going to be. Okay, last problem with poetry, the real problem with poetry. Let's see, I tried to remember what this passage was, but I don't even remember if I marked it. Yeah, what's the last, does anybody know what I'm going to try to find here? What's the main problem with poetry?
It imitates the worst part of your soul.
That's it. Good. It acts on, it not imitates, it acts on the worst part. The arts, they don't appeal to your reason. What do they appeal to?
What do you mean you cite?
Desires. Okay. The part that is easy to get excited about, a play, or a TV show, or a song, or whatever it is that art is doing. Music is the clearest example. The real problem with imitation is that it gets you, it feeds the desiring part of your soul. Socrates is connecting the account of imitation to the division of the soul. And in fact, that's what he does here. He brings back all his old tricks about the principle of non-contradiction and the soul can't do this and this at the same time, and he divides the soul into parts all over again. He says, well, look, imitation acts on the lower part of the soul. Well, that shouldn't be at all surprising to us. Why not? Yeah, John? It's the furthest away from the good. What else do we know about powers and objects that are set in? Imitation is set over things that are and are not. Desire, it's not just that it's set over what is and isn't. It also has the character of being and not being at the same time. Well, that's a weird thing to say. Did I just make that up? If I did, I made it up last class. In the class before. Where we notice that every time I feel pleasure, what am I also feeling? Pain. Because the pleasure is a filling and an emptying. Desires are just like imitations. They are and are not what they are at the same time. Pleasure is and is not pleasure at the same time. That part of our soul is not really real. It's an imitation. Well, what's the part of our soul that's set over the things that are really real? Reason is set over the good. If that's the case, then reason should be the part of our soul that is to a higher degree. While the other parts aren't really parts at all. And it's puzzling how they're even included. Right?
Yes,
it's a puzzle that we've seen a couple of times.
I don't know. Why did you have to even put them in the soul? Why couldn't you make it a one part soul, which is reason, and then you wouldn't have to.
Then you wouldn't have to eat?
Or you would, no,
you can just define the soul as pure reason and not.
No, it could be like not part of the soul or something else. I don't know. just by making it three parts and having them all be one thing, no, I should have
that was. It really has to be more than one part because of the law and non-contradiction.
Right.
Because of what?
The law and non-contradiction.
Yeah.
So there has to be at least two.
Well, why can't we do two separate things instead of two parts of the same thing?
Yeah, that's not good.
Why can't there be two separate things? Actually, we saw this in relation to the principle.
Because then you just rip yourself apart.
Well, that follows from the conclusion. And that's interesting, too. I'll come back to that in a second. Reason including all the desires. Isn't that how an imitation and a thing imitated works? Now it's starting to look like reason is an imitation. Desires are an imitation of reason. We don't get a contradiction if we have two things that aren't connected. If you can be thirsty and not drink, and have that be a conflict, there's one thing there that's in conflict. Somehow the desires are connected to reason. And if we go back to the beginning, the first thing we said about soul in here is that soul is just the difference between a living thing and a corpse. Right? So how do I know desires belong to the soul? The corpse doesn't have them. And not just that. I mean, when you think about a desire, it starts to look like something that is at least partially rational. Because it takes account of itself in some way. And the way Socrates talks about it is that desires act as if they're asking and answering questions. It's not just a lack of fluid that makes you thirsty. You have to have some sort of awareness of that lack. And the thirst is a sort of an awareness. It's not a real awareness. It's contradictory in some way. Because it doesn't realize that what it desires is for the soul to be full. It's not set over the soul. It thinks it desires the external object. But it's still only possible because of reason. If that's the case, then, well, reason is the whole soul. But there are also these parts. Because reason is connected to the body. And the only way it can preserve its own functioning is by having these parts be working properly. Yeah?
Didn't you say that when we die, we lose our desires too, so the soul also loses our desires? By the logic that if you have just a corpse doesn't have desires. If you have just a soul, it doesn't have desires either. So isn't it somehow connected to both? And to need it?
Yes. It's connected to both. It follows from the connection of the soul. Desires are there for the sake of reason. You can't reason in the body unless you can order the body correctly. And the desires are there as a means of ordering the body correctly. They're messages from the body.
Is there a desire to, like, have an ordered soul?
This is the way people usually replay them. And it's because it's the way we're trained to think about things. We're trained to be empiricists from a very early age. And empiricists have this problem. Reason never motivates you to do it. This is David Hume. You could realize that if you don't do a certain action, the whole world will be destroyed. You could realize that rationally and not care, unless you have some desire for the world not to be destroyed. Because desire is the only thing that motivates. That's the way we think of it. If reason is going to motivate, we have to make reason like a desire. But Plato doesn't need to say that. Why not? Because a desire is already like reason. It's just reason taking an external end.
So it's more like
it's stop of the desires are a sort of a stopping of reason by turning it out. But when it's not turned out, what's it turned to? The soul itself. That is its object. But it doesn't desire it in the way we think of desire, because we think of desire as having an external object. And it just is the ordered soul. The rational soul is the ordered soul. It's both the soul that's able to reason and the soul that makes sense to reason. Desires don't make sense because they stand opposed to reason. They shouldn't make sense. They're contradictory. Okay, let's actually do the immortality argument. What's the argument? Let's see if it. Let's do it, and then we'll go over this. Let's say the same thing one more time. It's worth repeating. I think everybody's starting to see it. At least starting, which is good. It's one of the most important books ever written, so it's good to have some idea of what it means. Why not? What else do you need? Watch football. I actually saw some football highlights this week accidentally, and I realized that I just don't like football. I mean, I really like sports. I love watching sports, but it's not like football. It's just totally barbaric. These guys are just... I just watch it. Why did their mothers let them? Well, I mean, their mothers must have let them play when they were younger. They just kill each other. They just, like, knock the whatever out of each other. It's really, it's kind of barbaric. It made me think about Michael Vick. I felt like I was watching trained pit bulls. And then this guy gets sent to jail for doing what somebody has done to him. Unbelievable. Anyways. Okay, how do we know that the soul is immortal? Only one thing can destroy each thing. So let's linger on that for a second. Is that true? You talked about this, I think, after you turned in your quotes. Joe, is it true?
I don't think so.
What?
Well, it says for the body that one thing is disease, but there's probably other ways that God is supposed to.
How can you die besides disease?
You put an average shell
by a car.
There were like answers that came at me right there.
You could drive.
I was set on fire. Play football for a living.
It seems to be a little bit. Those are all. We generally just kind of depend on how you define disease. You know?
Thank you. Okay, so how is Socrates defining disease here? How must he be defining disease for this argument to make any sense?
There's bad destruction of the body. There's disorder of the body.
Disorder of the body. If you cut the body in half, you radically disorder it. It's not a very long sickness, but it is a sickness. And if you set it on fire, man, this is a weird class. If you set it on fire, you are stopping it from being ordered properly and doing its function. In each case, the one bad of the thing is the taking away of the one good of that thing. And the good of everything that is its order. To take away the order of a thing is to destroy it, to make it cease to exist. Those are all the same things that could destroy the order of the body. it's still the order itself. And if you look at Socrates' examples, rock for wood and rust for metal, he's just talking about the disintegration or the dissolving of the order of the thing. We think about causes, like causes of destruction, as external. Baseball bats and football players and fires. He's thinking of the cause of destruction as internal to the thing. The baseball bat isn't going to destroy the table unless it takes away the order that is the table. And neither is the fire. If somehow the fire could preserve, if the table could preserve its order and structure after you light it on fire, the fire wouldn't destroy it. And if the body could somehow preserve its order or structure after you cut it in half, the cutting in half wouldn't cause it any problems. It's only the losing of the order or structure that's problematic. Is everybody there? Yeah, Brian?
Yeah.
Just trying to find that amusing. So, what could be funnier than somebody being cut in half?
So with that first premise, only one thing can destroy a thing that's like not necessary, right? It would just be like to destroy something is to cause it to be disordered. And injustice is what causes it to be disordered.
The cause of the destruction of the thing is the taking away of its unity or order.
Yeah.
So what are we going to have to say about the soul? If we're going to say that it's immortal, its unity or order can't be taken away. Injustice is the disorder of the soul. But injustice can never completely overtake the soul. The soul can never be completely disordered. Go ahead.
What about mental disease and crazy people?
We
no longer have the ability to reason.
We're in tyrants, drug addicts.
Tyrants, well, drug addicts.
Like,
are there souls destroyed?
I don't think it's sort of an asshole. It's not ordered anymore, necessarily.
How do you know that their soul is not destroyed?
Because they're still alive.
They're still alive. They're still breathing, and they still have desires, and they still. No matter how warped the person's soul gets, no matter how addicted to drugs or how demented somebody gets, if they're still alive, their soul hasn't been destroyed.
What could you argue?
Yes, it seems like they have the reason for the soul.
It doesn't seem like they have it.
Serving some other part of the soul, or what if someone becomes so addicted that they end up killing themselves, and so then because of their disorder, they were. Doesn't that seem like?
It's just saying that the injustices, what caused the disorder in the body.
It can't be the destruction of the body that destroys the soul. Why not? It's not the soul's bad, that's the body's bad. The destruction of the body, disease, destroys the body. But each thing has its own peculiar evil, and the soul's peculiar evil is its disorder, which is injustice. But look at people that are just radically unjust. Their souls aren't being destroyed at all. There's something there that is being preserved. That. Somehow the soul has a unity that can't be broken apart. It can't be taken away. Really, we've seen it even in the soul's division. To divide the soul into appetites and spirit and reason, or desire and spirit and reason, by noticing a contradiction. We have to notice that there is one thing that remains one even in its opposition to itself. There's a unity that underlies the division. Or, put it one more way here, if we associate the division with injustice and the unity with justice, we saw all the way back in Book 1 that injustice can't destroy justice. Why not? What's the argument that I'm thinking of?
Justice is more powerful.
That's the one, yeah. How do we know that justice is more powerful? An injustice without having some justice. The only power that injustice has, it gets from justice. If you take away the justice, or if the justice gets so weak that it can't function, the injustice will cease to function as well. Destroying the soul through injustice is like, it's like suffocating yourself. This is getting morbid today. It's like suffocating yourself by holding your breath.
Can't do it.
You'll pass out. And then you'll stop holding your breath. Because the only thing that's allowing you to hold your breath is your consciousness. You lose consciousness and you stop holding your breath, and then your consciousness will slowly come back. That's like the soul trying to destroy itself through injustice. If it gets close to being destroyed, it won't be able to continue being unjust anymore. And it'll continue to survive. It won't get to the point where it destroys itself. There is some underlying unity to the soul that can't be dissolved. Well, what kind of unity can't be dissolved? A unity that doesn't have any parts. That's it. A simple unity. If something has parts, you can break it into parts and destroy it. If something can't be broken into parts, it must be that it doesn't have parts. There is, at the core of the soul, a simple unity that can't be taken away. Well, let's just say what that simple unity is here, and then we'll answer some questions. What is the simple unity of the soul? Two answers you can give, and they'll both be right. Okay, three answers. Justice and the good are two of them. Yeah?
So the beautiful question.
Oh, it could be the beautiful too. All right, four answers. They're multiplying. The rational part is the unity of the soul. It's there already, underlying any sort of divisions. It has to be there for desires to even be possible. Yeah, go ahead, Joe. You had a question about 5 minutes ago.
I don't know. I'm not sure I agree with this argument, but I can't find one thing that I
good.
I just have a problem.
Perfect.
With
that sounds like a good paper topic.
I have a problem with the fact that, like, he says we know injustice cannot destroy the soul because if it did, then, you know, if you committed injustice, then you would die. That doesn't happen. People go on living unjustly. But at the same time, when trying to spit this out, but okay, so injustice cannot destroy the soul because you don't die when you're unjust. But when you do die, it's not a result of injustice because, you know, the soul's immortal. It seems like the same criteria, like it's not consistent, because if you would, because he says that the fact that we don't die when we're unjust points that, you know, that soul can't be destroyed by injustice. But then when you finally do die, he doesn't say, well, okay, then injustice just destroyed the soul. He says, well, The application of death is like the criteria for...
You want to say justice is not the body's evil. Injustice is not the body's evil. So of course it doesn't destroy the body. No, that's not what you want to say.
I just think the application of death as the criteria of... Oh, well, you can tell that, you know, injustice didn't destroy their soul because they're still alive.
But then when you do die, you can't say that...
It was because of injustice.
Yeah. It seems like a contradiction. It's a backup one thing, but then on the flip side, but the problem there is that the soul...
Claire's going to ask me a question also.
Well, I was just wondering how that this whole destruction thing worked with Book 8. Destruction of the city. It seems like they do destroy one city, they say, aristocracy. It seems to destroy itself by, and so does the next one and the next one. I mean, the last one doesn't seem to, but they do seem to they take something as a good in it.
Yep, it's true. The city and the soul turn out to be a little bit different here at the end.
The city still exists.
No, actually, I think the city can actually be destroyed. But we can see the difference in the same terms we've been using. It's the city that gets destroyed. Explicitly. The city is explicitly mortal in the book. In fact, it has to be destroyed, whereas the soul can't be destroyed. Well, why not? Well, what's the difference? The soul has a unity that is stronger or more complete than that of the city. The city, the parts really are parts, and the carpenter is over here, and the philosopher is over here. In the soul, the parts aren't really parts. They're the same thing, somehow acting in different ways.
Aren't the philosopher and the carpenter also that exact same thing? They're both just different perspectives on some good.
Yeah, they're both rational souls. The carpenter's also a rational soul. Okay, I want to read the Glaucus passage, and then we need to finish up the Republic and at least say something about the ethics, otherwise you won't believe me. Okay, page 312, 611. Let's look at 611. Well, let's not imagine that either, I said. Since the argument doesn't allow it, then let's certainly not imagine that in its truest nature, soul is the sort of thing that's filled with lots of variety, non-uniformity, and difference within itself. Soul in itself, in its truest nature, doesn't have any internal difference. No parts. Okay. It's not easy for something to be everlasting, I said, if it's composed of many parts, as the soul now appears to us to be. It doesn't have a perfectly beautiful composition. Likely not. Well, now the present argument, and others as well, would force us to conclude that the soul is immortal, but it has to be seen the way it is in truth, not deformed by its association with the body and other evils, the way we see it now. The way it was when it becomes pure has to be looked into adequately by reason. One will find it a far more beautiful thing and will see through the various conceptions of justice and injustice and all the things we've gone over now to something more clear. We were telling the truth about it now as it appears at present. With the condition it's in, however, we've been looking at it like people can't sight of Glaucus at sea, and can't see his original nature anymore, because some of the old parts of his body have been broken off by the waves, and others worn down and completely deformed. While other things have grown on him, shells and seaweed and rocks, so that he looks more like any sea monster than what he was by nature. And we too are looking at the soul, but it's in a condition like that as a result of myriads of evils. But Glaucon, one needs to look in a different place. The way we've been looking at the soul, even up until this point in the text, including declaring the analogy to the state, which we're now seeing is limited, has to do with the soul, the way it is, in its association with the body. When it's associated with the body, it's drawn in all these directions, it's broken apart into desires, it's forced to deal with all this externality, it's not in its natural state. We need to look in a different place. Where is that? At its philosophic desire to get an idea of what it reaches for and what sorts of things it strives to be in company with, since it's akin to what's divine, immortal, and always in being. And to consider what would become of it if the whole of it pursued that sort of thing, and it was lifted by that impulse out of the sea it now inhabits and had the rocks and shells that are now on it knocked off. Many crustaceans of earth and rock that grow wild all over it as a result of its allegedly having feasts, since what it feasts itself on is earth. Then one could see its true nature, whether its form is multiple or single, or in what respect and what manner it is that way. For now, as I imagine, done a decent job of going through the attributes and forms it has in human. Okay. It's akin to what's divine and immortal and always being. There is a part of your soul that is unified and is akin to the good. The unity of the soul is somehow attached to the good itself. And we've seen this really now for a couple of weeks, ever since books 6 and 7, when we saw that there is a knowledge that we don't get by putting it into the soul, but we get by turning the soul as a whole. That is the immoral part of the soul. And that's the intrinsic reward. This is why we're now at the point that he says it right here. We're now at the point where we see justice's own reward. Let's read the next paragraph. And as for the other things in our discussion, I said, didn't we rescue justice without bringing up the wages or reputation for it the way you folks claim Hesiod and Homer do? Instead, didn't we find justice itself to be best for the soul itself, and that just things need to be done by it, whether it has Gyges' ring or not, and besides such a ring, Hades' captive. Okay. What's the internal reward for justice? Go ahead, Brian. Okay, the good, or something like it. Well, why is it good for the soul to be just? That's its work. Did it? Yeah. We need to see the tautology. What does it mean to be just?
A
well-ordered soul. And why is the well-ordered soul good?
Because it's just.
That sounds like a tautology. It's closer to the unity of the core of itself. Why is the unity of the core of itself good? It's because it is. To be just is to be. And the more just you are, the more you are. The reward for justice is being. How could you not want to be? Because being is the good, and everybody, everything desires the good. The internal reward for justice is reward itself. It's to be in an immortal and divine-like state. The more just you are, the more immortal you are. Not as an extent of being, but as a type of being. To be is to be one, and to be just is to be one. To be just is to be. The theme of this course, other than just to investigate the Republic for most of the semester, was essentially how views on reality or metaphysics underpin views on what's good or ethics. In Plato, it's hard to even, when you get to the end, it's hard to even raise that as a question. Ethics is just the metaphysics of being a human being. To be a human being completely is to be ethical. Your being just has nothing to do with doing what's right in society. Speaking the truth and paying your debts, although that might be involved. And none of the rewards for justice, none of the real rewards have anything to do with that. Although Socrates goes on to say that the just person gets all the rewards ultimately also. The reward for being just is just being all that you can be. It's being to the greatest possible extent. It's a state of immortality insofar as we're capable of that even in the body. Which is pretty cool. Yeah.
Is that about the extent of how he accounts for the existence of injustice and bad things in the world, just saying that they have less being? It's like when I was looking at how everything was an imitation of the good or the just, and they only have their existence, through that. It just seems to eliminate that anything could be innately bad or that, that there is injustice at all. But obviously those things exist, but is he just saying that they're less real, I guess, or?
Yes. Yes. But what is bad?
Lack of good.
Yeah, it's just a limited good. To be bad is just to be incompletely good. Okay, we've got a whole nother text to deal with. We only have 2 weeks for Spinoza. I don't even think we have 2 weeks. Like a week and a half or something. So we're not gonna be able to do this book justice. There's just no way. This book really deserves as much time as the Republic. I mean, it's really it's that worthwhile. But what we can do is this, we're going to see the same sort of relationship in Spinoza. So that's what I want to focus on. I want to focus on how it is in Spinoza that being and ethics line up. And we can do it by reading the first three sections. But we're going to do it quickly. The first section is it's about God. It's about substance and about what it means to be. The second section is about ideas or knowledge, what it is to know. That's interesting because we just read a book about how knowing and being are connected. And now we're going to read another one about that. It's going to turn out that they're connected again, although in a slightly different way. And then the last one we want to read is on the emotions. Three. The origin and nature of the emotions. And the emotions are not as good as thinking. We've already seen that. We're going to see it again in another way, I suppose. But the first thing to get clear on, the most important thing to get clear on, is what substance is. That's what book one is about. So let's just say it a little bit about it right now to get started. What is substance? Well, there's a definition here. Definition out loud. By substance, I mean that which is in itself and is conceived through itself.
So it doesn't need any external relations at all.
It's in itself and is conceived through itself. That is, that the conception of which does not require the conception of another thing from which it has to be formed. Is a substance.
So it doesn't require external objects to be
Yeah, it's an independent thing. That's what substance always means in philosophy. A substance, although what it means to be an independent thing turns out to be vastly different depending on who you're reading, and we're getting an extreme view here. To be a substance is to be something that exists through itself. Well, what does it mean to exist through yourself? Well, let's look at the first definition here. By that which is self-caused, I mean that whose essence involves existence, or that whose nature can be conceived only as existing. Self-caused? I thought self-caused means, well, just imagine what a cause is. Carpenter makes a set of bookshelves. The carpenter is the cause of the bookshelves. I thought self-cause just means something that makes itself. And here he tells me, well, what that means is that its essence involves existence. Well, why is that? How do we get from self-caused to essence involves existence? Or always existence? What's the puzzle of causing yourself? You have to exist before you exist. Otherwise you couldn't exist. You wouldn't be there to cause yourself unless you existed before you existed to cause yourself. To be self-caused just means to exist in and through yourself. And something that is self-caused always has to be. Because the difference bring it into being self-caused. It exists even before it exists, or in Spinoza's way of putting it, it can't be conceived not to exist. But that's substance. Substance is the thing that is self-caused. On Tuesday, we're gonna fly through book one. Most important thing that we're going to have to come to understand is that there is only one substance. There's only one thing that can be, that is self-caused and exists in and through itself. It's got a name. God. So Tuesday we'll figure out what God is, and then move on to the mind on Wednesday.